Tonight's talk is a review of the Third Noble Truth, the alleviation of dukkha, liberation from dukkha. This is one of a series of talks that I'm giving on the Four Noble Truths. This notion of liberation from dukkha has different characteristics depending on how one describes the process or what the goal is. As I've said so many times, the origination of Buddhism occurred in a culture that was undergoing a lot of transformation, but was very different than ours. Not just because it was on a different part of the planet, the Indian subcontinent, but also because the nature of civilization was such that everything had to be transmitted by word of mouth, all the information from one generation to the next. So for hundreds of years, the teachings were memorized and then chanted so that there was the potential for what we call cultural drift. So the school of Buddhism that I have been studying mostly for the last 40 years is called Theravada Buddhism. And Theravada is translated as the path of the elders. And it has been represented by the Theravadins as the original teachings of the Buddha. And then from that spun off the Mahayana tradition, which became spread across to China and then to Japan. And Japan is the Zen, China is Chan. And then up into the Tibetan plateau, where it became what's called Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle. So we don't know for sure what the Buddha actually taught. The Four Noble Truths discourse is considered to be the first teaching of the Buddha after his awakening. But contemporary scholarship, which is, you know, obviously enhanced by the internet, by the ability of scholars all around the world to dive deep into the traditions, the history. So we don't believe now, or the scholars don't believe, that what is written down now as the first discourse of the Buddha, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, discourse on the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, is probably not something that sprang forth from the Buddha's mouth. It evolved. It probably evolved during the course of his ministry, if you will, and also after his passing. But there are some elements that are pretty reliable in it. And the notion of liberation from dukkha is a core consideration in that regard. At the time of the Buddha, the whole notion of liberation was described as taking many, many lifetimes. The concept of rebirth was current in that time and for centuries afterwards. In fact, it's still the case in Hinduism and in Theravadin and other Buddhist traditions, the Mahayana tradition, so forth and so on. So this process of awakening is what we're talking about here in a traditional sense. So core aspect of this is called the achievement or the experience of nirvana, or nibbana in Pali, which is part of the Theravada tradition. It's a quality of awareness that is unconditioned. Total absence of any sense of duality. What that means is that there's an experience that has no characteristics of a subject-object process. There's no witnesser that is separate from what is being witnessed. Now, in the Taoist tradition, this is called one with the Tao. I believe in Islam, this is, submitting to the will of Allah. Could be called God consciousness in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Moksha in the Hindu tradition. But this quality of non-duality is a core aspect of this. Someone who is experiencing this, is the experience of being awakened, is called Bodhi. And a person who has experienced this awakening is called a Buddha or an Arhant. Someone who's aspiring to this is called a bodhisattva, one who seeks the experience of liberation, total liberation, nirvana. Another core concept that's involved with the Third Noble Truth is shunyata, which is traditionally translated as emptiness or voidness. So that has an unusual connotation in our era because, we have these sophisticated concepts of interstellar space, which supposedly is empty of any substance. Right now, where there's a lot of confusion about what that means, because there obviously something is going on because light is coming from stars thousands of light years away, and somehow or other is coming through to us here on Earth. So even that notion of emptiness is confusing. I have repurposed the understanding of shunyata. I think what's more useful is a fundamental absence of singularity or autonomy. Singularity, we could say that a piece of wood is singular. And superficially it is. But if you zoom in on it with a very powerful microscope, an electron microscope, there'll come a point of magnification where the boundary between what is the quote-unquote solid wood and the atmosphere around it kind of dissolves, becomes atomic or even subatomic. So this whole notion of singularity ignores a basic concept of physics that is being really deeply investigated currently by contemporary physicists. So the notion of autonomy is also implicit in this. When there's a sense of autonomy, it seems that there's an actor and there's an acted upon. So someone who is autonomous is in control, can make things happen. And of course, it seems obvious. I'm speaking, I'm making sound happen in a particular way that is understood as language, specifically the English language. So on a superficial social level, there certainly is a sense of autonomy. Obviously, I'm the one who's speaking and you all are the ones who are listening. But diving deeper into this process, the whole notion of what autonomy means in terms of a personality is also not all that solid. I've talked about this many times before, about what in modern psychology is called attachment theory. The word attachment in this context of attachment theory is not really related to the Buddhist concept of clinging or upadana, or which is also translated as attachment. What the whole notion of attachment means in psychology is that the whole sense of personality, each of us has a personality. It exists because of relationship with others. Children don't really have a personality, but the exchanges with other persons or with social norms creates a sense of self and other. The structure of language does this, with nouns and so forth and so on. So this whole notion of autonomy has that kind of a social value or validity, but in the context of dukkha, we really have to look close at what we believe is a separate self. And that's really what this practice is about, the Four Noble Truths. It's, in a sense, realized in the context of the Third Noble Truth. The Fourth Noble Truth, the Noble Eightfold Path, which I'll be talking about in depth going forward, is the ways and means for realizing the Third Noble Truth. So the Third Noble Truth is a way of diving deep into our subjective experience, to understanding the basic characteristics of it. So the sense of having a self is very complex, because it's interactive. Environmental changes affect subjective changes. Temperature changes, taking in food, going to sleep, listening to people, driving a car. All of these are interactive in the context of the how the environment is stimulating what are called the sense doors. Visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, you know, flavor, what you sense in your body, pain, pleasure, hunger, fatigue, so forth and so on. Interacting with our subjectivity, which once again is created, fabricated from prior experience. So this is what sunyata is meant to point to. Of course, in the context of the teachings, another manifestation of sunyata is called anatta, which is the absence of an autonomous, enduring self. So realizing this is what the Third Noble Truth is oriented toward. That's the goal. So, in terms of understanding this process, there are some things in the teachings that are useful. One of them that talks about sunyata, or a shorter form of the word is sunya, is found in what's called the Fina Sutta, related to the five aggregates of clinging. The five aggregates of clinging are a way for Buddhism to describe, or the Buddha to describe, personality structure. Form is sensation. What you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you taste, when you bump into something, when the temperature changes, take in food, so forth and so on. That's form. Perception is how the mind starts to separate out the stimulation into categories like sight or with sight, there would be color, edge, and form, movement, rather, excuse me, movement. Feeling is like an emotional reaction, going toward or moving from emotionally, what we call in modern psychology an affect. The third aspect is what we call fabrication or mental conditioning. And all of this is reflected in consciousness. So this is the way that Buddhism tries to describe a personality. So here's a quote from the Fina Sutta. It was translated by Bhikkhu Sujato. Form is like a lump of foam. Feeling is like a bubble. Perception seems like a mirage. Choices like a banana tree. And consciousness like a magic trick. So taught the kingsmen of the sun. However, you contemplate them, examining them carefully. They're void and hollow when you look at them closely. So form is like a lump of foam. When you think about a bubble bath, you know, there's a foam bubbles, but they dissipate over time. Feeling is like a bubble. You know, bubbles pop. They come into being and then they dissolve. Perception is like a mirage. It's interesting, if you're out in the desert or just out in the sun in a relatively flat area, you can see off in the distance, it looks like there's something floating. That's a mirage. That's a misperception, the way that light operates in the context of the interaction between the sun and the surface of the planet. And choices, which is mental formations, fabrications, like a banana tree. The reason they use the banana tree as the simile is because bananas have no heart. You know, oak has a heart. There's a dense center. But bananas, trees, have no dense center. And consciousness, like a magic trick. You know, the magic trick part is the sense of self. So this magic is what's described in terms of the first and second noble truths. The one element of the magic is dukkha, the distress and confusion that we all experience, and the other element is the cause of dukkha, which is craving and clinging. Craving is related to feeling, and clinging is related to perception and mental fabrications. So when we investigate the aggregates very carefully, it's possible to notice the transitory and ephemeral and insubstantial nature of self-experience. That's the third noble truth. That's the realization of it. Now, what we're doing right now is talking about the concept of nirvana or of emptiness, sunyata. The actual experience of the third noble truth is, you know, what the practice is all about. That's what the path is all about. The Noble Eightfold Path is ways and provides the ways and means for realizing that. So, how is the third noble truth described? Here's a passage from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, translated by Tanissaro. In this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. Something that's really interesting about the Buddhist teachings, is that the words have specifically applicable meanings. They're meant to be useful, like tools. So what I often do is talk about the words in these different passages. Cessation of stress, that's the third noble truth. Now, stress is the way Tanisiro is describing dukkha, or translating dukkha. My preferred translation is, you probably know, is distress and confusion. Distress relates to the felt sense of urgency, the affective quality of your experience, and confusion relates to the fabrication, the magic trick. So, cessation of distress and confusion, remainderless fading and cessation. Now, that's something that's important to understand, this notion of fading. My understanding from my own practice is that when I'm deep into the practice, coordinating samadhi paccati, samadhi is stability of attention, and paccati is the tranquility in the mind, the non-reactive present moment awareness, mindfulness. The characteristics of thinking, of feeling and perception are at a remove, fading. It's sort of like the volume has been turned down, or if you're talking about an image, a visual image, it starts to fade, like what happens when a fog obscures something at a distance. And cessation is that interest in identifying with that fading quality diminishes. It's just not interesting anymore to be caught up in whatever the mind concocts as thoughts. That's an important thing to understand. A common misperception about this practice is that thoughts go away. And, you know, to a large extent, this is a valid notion. But they don't go away necessarily. Well, they go away because that's the nature of thinking. It changes. But they also fade in the way I just described, become fainter in a way. But the aspect of cessation is that when you really notice the process, it's impermanent. Thoughts are constantly changing. It's only when we become fascinated or enchanted by whatever the concoction, the fabrication is, that we get stuck. This comes about, cessation of stress comes about as a result of renunciation first. Every time you mindfully notice the formation of some kind of internal commentary, some selfing, and you let it go and you go back to the breath, go back to the body, that's renunciation. That's what letting go is. Relinquishment is what happens when the mind is at such a state of balance and clarity and non-reactivity that the whole notion of there being a duality, an observing self and that which is observed, even if that which is observed is a thought, falls away. There's a quality of present moment awareness that is non-dual. There's no subject-object. There's just what forms. So in that regard, a thought, a person who is experiencing nirvana can be aware of the mind creating a thought, but it's like a bubble, just like it's described, or a mirage. It's not believable. It's not demanding of attention and action. That's my understanding of what the experiencing of the unconditioned is. So it's possible that a person who is experiencing the unconditioned could be noticing, be aware that there's sound or there's a sensation in the body, but there's no sense that there's a self that is other than the sound or other than the experience in the body. It might be pressure, something like that. I think that that's what it means. It's a total liberation from identification with the phenomena that's occurring as being a self. Now, this is one of the things that's been batted about since the very early days of Buddhism and is still being debated these days. This notion of what it takes to experience the unconditioned. The Theravadan tradition says that one must develop at least the first jhana. So I'm going to talk about the jhanas now. The first jhana basically is a quality of attention that is free from, that is caught up in a kind of ecstatic state. There's a feeling that's very enticing, very interesting. The mind is not vulnerable to the hindrances. There's a lot of stability of attention. And then that further develops into the second, third, fourth jhana. And the fourth jhana is kind of subdivided into the four formless jhanas. So early Theravada Buddhism said you have to enter at least the first jhana before you can really practice vipassana, before you can experience insight, and you cannot experience liberation, the third noble truth, without that training. Over the centuries, the practice became less and less, the path became less and less about highly developed states of concentration, jhanas, more and more about insights into anicca, dukkha, and anatta, impermanence, distress and confusion, and the absence of an enduring autonomous self. So that's what it's has evolved over the centuries. Contemporary Buddhism, there's still the monastic tradition and a significant number of contemporary teachers still say that you must achieve jhana, mostly monastic teachers. But there are teachers who say you don't really have to achieve jhana. You do have to create a quality of stability, samadhi, and non-reactivity, paucity, in the mind. It's called access concentration. Just preliminary to the first jhana. Without having to go into those exclusive states of jhana, but you can go to this access concentration area and then practice vipassana or insight into the three characteristics. So that's what this process is about. This is what the Buddha taught. He said, you know, he could concentrate his mind to the highest degree possible. That did not provide liberation from dukkha. What did, though, was after he came out of the jhanas, he saw how craving and clinging creates a self. He saw that that creation is a fabrication. It's dynamic. It's transitory. And he saw it with great clarity. The way I've described this in the past is you can imagine that concentration is like a laser. If you take light from a light bulb and it radiates the room, it's not very powerful. It's not very stable. But if you take that same energy that powers the filament of the light bulb and you run it through a device called a laser, out of the business end of the laser comes a beam that's extremely coherent, very little diminishment of energy, minuscule loss of energy. So it's very powerful. That's what jhana creates. With vipassana, what you want to do is put a mirror in front of that laser beam and reflect the light of the laser back onto the device itself to illuminate how the laser operates, in this case how the self operates. And you see that is a process. It's not substantial. It's not enduring. It's not a self. And that leads to this experience of bodhi, of awakening, of shunyata, which is the emptiness part. And that's what provides liberation. Now, back to the traditional rendition, the capital A awakening, there are four different levels of awakening that are described traditionally. Now, this is only in the Theravada tradition. The Mahayana Buddhism, particularly Chan or Zen or Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism, they don't talk about this. They use different terminology, but they don't talk about these four categories. So that's something that's very interesting. Because all the masters in these different traditions, the ones who have experienced in Zen, Nirvana is called Satori. The experiencing of Nirvana is called Satori. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's called ultimate bodhicitta. Bodhi is awakened. Citta is mind. Ultimate basically is full awakening. So there's different terminology. But in the context of traditional Buddhism, first is what's called stream entry, first experience of Nirvana. That involves a profound realization, a direct understanding, a knowing that there is no enduring autonomous self. I mean, that's kind of the doorway, the gateway into Nirvana. It becomes abundantly clear there is no object observer dynamic whatsoever. Whatever comes up is just suchness. It's just reflected in consciousness without any kind of feeling or perception or conditioning. Along with that is a realization that sense desire and ill will are traps. They're not as promising in terms of identifying with them and acting on them as craving and clinging would incline one to believe. There's also a realization that the Four Noble Truths Pass is valid. It's the proof of it. I've talked about this many times. There's conceptual understanding, and then there's the subjective aha moment, in which you realize, oh, what I read about, what I heard about, this is it. This is it. I know it. There's also a realization that any kind of rites or rituals, either involved with a religious practice or the kind of rites and rituals that we typically adopt socially in order to have a quote-unquote normal life, are they're not necessary. They're not necessary. This does not mean that a person becomes antisocial or anarchic. It just simply means that you realize that it's a social custom. Religious rituals are social customs. So that's the first thing. That's stream entry. And it's said that once you experience stream entry, this is a transformative event in one's life. But the whole process of full awakening is not complete. The next one is called a once returner. So the drives of sense, desire, and ill will are even more diminished. A person who lives that way lives simply. They do not require a lot of entertainment or toys or physical comforts. They can still live in that context, but it's not, there's no craving and clinging associated with it. It's interesting that when I say this, it comes to mind is when someone was taking the Dalai Lama into New York City. The Dalai Lama as a boy was very interested in mechanical things, particularly stuff like clocks and watches. So they took him to a particular neighborhood in Manhattan where the whole street was full of this kind of technology, clocks and watches and so forth. And he would look in the windows and his comment was, you know, it's really interesting to know what they are, but I feel no need for them. Another thing that comes to mind is Socrates was traveling with his students through the Agora, which is the marketplace of Athens. And they said to him, Master, why are you here in the Agora? You don't own anything. You don't need anything. And his comment was, I'm here to realize the relief of not needing any of this anymore. So those are indicative of what a person who has experienced non-returner is about. So you can see there's a diminishment from the first stream entry, once returner. Then the next level is the non-returner, which is completely relinquished, sense, desire, and ill will. No matter what their life circumstances are, completely at peace. Then the final one is the arahant. And this is the equivalent to the Buddha, fully awakened being. So an arahant directly knows the experience of nibbana, does not have to go through any kind of meditation or anything like that, to kind of live in a world that is kind of integrates the unconditioned with functioning. Now, the Buddha, obviously, he did not become socially inept after his full awakening. He went on to create Buddhism over the course of next several decades. So the whole notion of being an arahant does not mean that someone checks out. It basically means that their presence is not at all afflicted by dukkha to any extent. Now, when I say that, they're not afflicted by sankhara dukkha or viparinama dukkha. Viparinama dukkha is the dukkha that's associated with change. Sankhara dukkha is the dukkha that's associated with mental fabrications. There's dukkha dukkha, which is basically hunger, pain, fatigue, so forth and so on. That was not eliminated. Some of the doctrine says that this whole notion of Nirvana, the Buddha wasn't fully awakened completely until Parinirvana. So this is part of what fed into the whole notion of the Bodhisattva vow. Fully enlightened being, it would be selfish to check out without activating the compassion that comes from recognizing all the suffering in the world. So when the Buddha died, that's called the Parinirvana. And basically, at that point, any residual karma at all was completely, the fuel was completely burned out. That's the way Theravada Buddhism talks about it. Okay, now, this supposedly, traditionally, takes place over multiple lifetimes. The whole notion of this lifetime has some controversy associated with it. Once again, there are some contemporary teachers. Buddhadasa, I think, is one of them. He's a very well-respected monk. I think he's no longer alive anymore, but he certainly was alive during the last half century. He said the whole notion of rebirth does not pertain to what happens, you know, as the body is born and grows up and grows old and dies. It's the repeated conditioning that creates the notion of there being an enduring autonomous self. That's the rebirth that we want to work with. And I personally think that that's what the historical Buddha was teaching. That's my belief. So this notion of the experience of liberation has this quality of transcendence, of more and more mysticism, if you will. But what I propose, and I think a lot of contemporary teachers propose, that the process of awakening is incremental. I mentioned the renunciation, letting go. Every time we let go of any kind of preoccupation other than simple embodied awareness, that's a moment of awakening. That's a moment of liberation from dukkha. Being presently aware, whether there's physical discomfort or not, being presently aware in a non-reactive way that is not being jerked around, the mind is not jumpy or being enchanted by some thought or supposition. And there's that flow of present moment, non-reactive, peaceful awareness. That's liberation from dukkha. We call that a state. Now, what we're trying to accomplish here is to mature a state of renunciation, of awakening, into a trait, which means that a whole series of states are strung together. They become more and more normative, more and more accessible in a person's life. That's what we're trying to cultivate. That's what I'm practicing cultivating, so that I live a life that's more wholesome, kinder, more beneficial in terms of what I actually do, you know, my profession, my relationships, my activities, so forth and so on. That's my aspiration, that's my path. Now, I'll be talking about these qualities as we start to investigate the Noble Eightfold Path, which will begin next week. So this process of awakening, I don't think it's necessary to be preoccupied with nirvana. If something happens that is extraordinary in that regard. I think that there's a validity to that. I do think that a person can experience an extraordinary state of mind. I personally have experienced jhana many, many years ago. I do know that that's true. You know, that's valid for me because I experienced the characteristics that are described in the literature. And I was able to reproduce it for probably a year or maybe a little bit more on a regular basis. But that went away, hasn't come back since. But the whole notion of experiencing this sense of disengagement from what the mind is churning up. You know, I believe that something goes on in the brain all the time that generates some kind of commentary, some kind of imagery, some expectations, so forth and so on. I think that's what a brain does. Just like, you know, a duck quacks, a brain thinks. I believe that we can cultivate a quality of awareness that is aware of thinking in the same way it might be aware of a sound in the environment, without really being interested in it or commanded by it. I think that that's a legitimate process of liberation from dukkha. It just fades away. So those are my comments about the Third Noble Truth. So we now have the opportunity for people to ask questions. Or make comments. And there are two people in the room with me, Mindy and John. And just for y'all's knowledge, Julian is with us, and Steve, and Sharon Lambert, and Heather Johnson. So, questions or comments?
How did you know you were in jhana?
I was practicing body scan and was very intense about doing it and very persistent about doing it on a retreat, one of those Goenka retreats. And I noticed that there was a particular sensation. I couldn't tell you where it was. Over time, when I could reproduce it, the sensation could be practically anywhere in the body. But I'll just say that it was in my chest. There was an ecstatic feeling that I could focus on, become more and more absorbed into, kind of fall into it. And I could expand it. You know how you put a dab of butter on toast and you spread it around? Well, that's what you do with body sweep. You kind of spread sensations around. I was spreading around this blissful feeling. It was really an orgasmic feeling. Moving it around my body, spreading it, until my whole body was full of it. And that became my primary focus of attention. It was very interesting. I was not very interested at all in what was going on around me. So it's called an absorption, and I was certainly absorbed in that. That's the first jhana. I had to decide to do it, to intend to move my attention around, to intend to focus on it. The second jhana, the intention to do that, that intention is called vitaka and vichara, aiming and sustaining. In the second jhana, that intention was no longer required. I just fell into it more and more easily, with more and more sustainability, persistence, almost like effortless. So that feeling filled up my whole body. And looking closer at that led into the third jhana. The third jhana is a realization that that orgasmic feeling in the first and second jhana is not, it's crude. It's not as refined as it could be. So what happens is that ecstasy falls away and is replaced by calmness and happiness. I would break into this silly grin. It's just it's happening involuntarily. And that's the third jhana, and the mind is very stable, less and less engagement, interest, involvement with whatever's going on elsewhere in the body or outside the body. I was able to move in and out from the first jhana to the second jhana, the third jhana, back to the first jhana or back to the second jhana. In other words, being able to navigate through those. I went on a jhana retreat with Lee Brazington out in New Mexico during that period of time, and I became even more adept at it and was able to get into the edge of the fourth jhana. The fourth jhana, that happiness seems crude. There's a way to realize an even more refined quality of attention that is very, very peaceful. My memory of it was like going down a tube very, very rapidly. There's no wall to the tube, but it was that sense of going very rapidly down a tube that was very, very smooth, isolated from everything, all the sounds in the area, sensations elsewhere in the body. It was dominantly a mental experience that was very calm. There was no more happiness. There was just tranquility. Very peaceful. So I was able to get into that state a few times during the retreat. Now, if I had gone further and further into that, that would be entry into what are called the formless jhanas, which are purely mental states. You leave, you know, I was losing interest in any kind of embodied sensational experience. It was just not interesting anymore in the fourth jhana. I could understand, I could infer from that, from what I had read about the jhanas, that that quality of consciousness becomes more and more purely consciousness and less embodied. And that's what the formless jhanas are. I have no experience of them. But that was my jhana practice. And I was able to do that pretty regularly for quite a while. I came back from the retreat and I'd be teaching on Wednesday nights and I could flip into the third jhana. It was weird. But it went away and it hasn't come back since. And I've tried several times over the decades since then, particularly on my last 3-month retreat, to get back into that. Didn't work. So I've decided my practice is cultivating access concentration using breath awareness and body awareness and then noticing the ephemeral quality of thoughts. They just kind of fade out. They're not interesting anymore. I can tell. It's like somebody being in the other room. If I really want to, I can hear what they're saying, but I'm not particularly interested in hearing what they're saying. So the thoughts are like that. So that's my answer to your question.
So when you said you flipped in and out, was that only during a sitting or was that like in your daily life?
Only during a sitting.
And do you think that that perhaps that is what it's meant to be? That there is no striving to go back to it? Like what you experienced is all that needed to be experienced?
That would be a great rationale, wouldn't it?
I'm good at that.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, and it's less and less important to me. I am not discounting the benefit that I got from experiencing that at all. I'm not trying to suggest that people shouldn't do that. Don't need to do that at all. Now, the way I went into it is different than the way it's described traditionally. Traditionally, it's just the sensation around the rim of the nostrils that transforms into a light or a vibration, and then the mind gets absorbed in that without the full body kind of component. That's actually a more traditional teaching about jhana. And I've practiced that. I've tried to do that without much success. For me, going to jhana was always a full body experience. It could happen again. It could happen the next time I sit. It could happen the next time I go on retreat. But I'm more interested now in noticing that fading and cessation part than the entering into jhana part. Other questions or comments? John?
I'm in my 49th year of sitting. I did the first 20 of TM because I was in television. I was an editor and I worked all night long, so this is what I would do to de-stress. TM is like Vipassana, except that you're on a sound, a mantra. You focus on a mantra instead of focusing on the in-breath and the out-breath. So then I met Peter in 93 and I switched over to breath, and it was very common because I got the same result from each. And my spin on it is that there are visual learners, there are audio learners, and there are gut learners. Peter's a gut learner. I mean, and he does body scan like Flash Gordon. Took me forever to get to a Flash Gordon place because within 2 months, I mean, I'm visual as a firecracker, I transcended. That's what they called it in TM. And I relate that to a jhana because I consider it, if you consistently sit, it might take you several years, it might take you 3 months, you'll experience non-thinking. And so that's what I do. Ever since I've sat, like I said, 49th year, I sit every day for at least 45 minutes to a couple hours. And I just love it because it re-energizes me. But what happens to me is my mind will go into no-think. And that's what I believe is jhana. And there are degrees of jhana because you really energize. And it is very fascinating to me the different way the mind works. To pick up your energy and focus. And it's amazing to me. Like I will have, I haven't been working in the last 6 months. I've been fighting with retirement or opening up an acupuncture office if I sell my house. So I've been like back at square one, whereas it was always a treat to sit because I could relax. It would turn my brain off. You know, I'm not a wine drinker. I'm not a do anything. I love my city, and so that's all I'm telling. But if you consistently sit, you'll get to a place where your mind will be still, and you'll get great stress relief as you re-energize, and great insights. And I don't know any other way to put it except that it's why I still come, and you know I've known Peter forever, and it's a great process, you know what I mean? But I was very surprised in the last 6 months that I've had so much activity in my mind. It was like going back to square one to quiet down. But then I would always quiet down and I would bump into no thought, is what I call it. Call it transcendence, call it jhana. And, you know, when I was a kid, I used to dream and I'd have colors that would come in and I'd wake up crying. I was so weird. As the body calms down, the energy kind of goes through the body, and that's how it was explained to me as a kid. I don't know. I'm just relaying to you my experience because I can, you know, I'll see a color and it'll just be no thinking. I'm not having any thoughts, and it's great, you know. So I must say, it's every day getting up is an adventure. What can I say?
Thank you, John. Other questions or comments?
Lash, what do you think about mantras?
What do I think about mantras? I think they're a way to concentrate the mind. The thing that the Buddha, now, and you know, in contemporary Buddhism or traditional Buddhism uses mantras. It's a way to stabilize attention, but I don't think that the Buddha practiced mantras. I think the Buddha did what I teach people to do, which is to sit and be present with your breath and your body. I think that's what he taught. And he would talk to people and explain to people what his experience was, but that's really what he was about. So, next week, I'm going to start to talk about the Noble Eightfold Path. And thank you for your participation and your practice. As usual, we will have our brief closing meditation. Thank you for your practice. I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to